This is the Erasing Shame Podcast, Season 5, Diverse Perspectives Discussing What Matters. On this episode of Erasing Shame, we're talking about cancel culture. My name is DJ Chuang. I'm joined by my co-hosts, George Chong, Hannah Lee Sandoval, and Leah Abraham. Thank you for joining me.
Good to be here again.
Well, I'm going to start with reading the Wikipedia entry on cancel culture, and it says it is a modern form of ostracism in which someone is thrust out of social or public circles, whether it be online, social media, or in person, and those subject to this ostracism are said to be canceled. And you know what? This kind of connects to shame, because in our Asian culture, we've had forms of public shaming for centuries, and perhaps cancel culture is just the digital form of that. What do you all think?
I'll share. We were just discussing how, actually, to piggyback and respond, DJ, you were talking about how Asians do it and disowning people or excommunicating from a community, a family, a church. Those are all kind of maybe other words for cancel culture. And a lot of us don't always connect those ideas. I think when we hear cancel culture, we kind of associate it with like younger people who are on social media, joining these larger trends on Twitter or YouTube. But yeah, connecting it to like, no, this is a dynamic that we've actually been experiencing a very, very long time. Every time a parent is upset that their child doesn't listen, then they'll be like, you're not my son or daughter. That's a cancel move, right? Maybe a bit more private than the public shaming online, but it's this idea of rejection because of your behavior, which doesn't allow for a lot of dialogue or negotiation, but brings up a lot of shame and hurt.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like what that looks like in Indian communities and families. And I remember growing up, my parents telling me, is like, if you are confused on what to do, just think about how the community will respond and react to it. And that should give you the answer whether you should do that or not. So using right. even that shame and possible cancel culture mm-hmm. as a compass to like, what is the right decision, or... That was very weird for me.
Yeah. I think in my experience, growing up in the Hmong community, a big part of cancel culture was in how American you were becoming and whether or not you were throwing away Hmong tradition. And so a big way that we experience cancel culture, especially in Christian contexts, is when you become a Christian, you're essentially throwing away tradition, you're throwing away family. And so in response, your family then disowns you in that space because you're no longer honoring ancestors, you're no longer fearing the spirits. And a lot of it for them is the fear of like the... repercussions that the spiritual realm would then hand out to the rest of the family, right? So there is a spiritual aspect to it. There is kind of this cultural aspect to it. And that was probably my first introduction to cancel culture, at least in the Hmong context, was, mm-hmm. oh, you're a Christian. That means you're, you know, accepting a white man's religion, that means you're, you know, not caring about your culture anymore. And it was kind of like an unsafe space to kind of exist, at least in the midst of more traditional Hmong people.
So I'm hearing that in our cultures, it's very much like, if you cancel us by behaving outside our cultural social norm, we will cancel you in kind. And cancel is sort of understood as rejection and distancing. And there's a lot of shame, definitely, and breaking of relationship built into that. I was reflecting, and we've been talking about you know, whenever somebody who's really public and kind of, you know, has a platform, so whether they're celebrities or politicians or just, you know, influencers, when they make mistakes, even if it happened 12, 20 years ago and it surfaces, then there's this movement to call it out. And I think the debate for a lot of people I've dialogued with is, you know, is that calling out of past mistakes, whether it was yesterday or a decade ago, is that accountability? And is that helpful and useful and important? Like in the Me Too movement, absolutely, right? And it's like sexism, racism, abuse. But then like when does that public accountability become public shaming that is now a weapon that doesn't allow for actual growth after personal mm-hmm. accountability? And, you know, Anna Akana's video that Leah sent to us talks about like the ability for people to evolve and how cancel culture sort of seems to have a spectrum. So that's been kind of an interesting space to explore and kind of watch how people are talking about it. I don't know if you guys have had thoughts on that.
It's interesting because I kind of wrestle with the question of, is there a place for cancel culture at all? Like, is it something that's in the good side of the spectrum and the bad side of the spectrum, or is it morally neutral?
Yeah.
So I don't, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I think immediately my response is there's a balance in how we experience shame, right? Shame is good in the way that we recognize that maybe something that we've done isn't right or isn't acceptable, right? And it's good to be confronted by that so that we know, right, what's right and what's wrong. But at the same time, weaponizing shame, right, or kind of using it to teach a lesson, right? Even in a lot of work that I do with patients or with clients and their parents, right? Parents are like, well, I want them to feel this so that they know not to do this next time, right? And it's like, is that really the best way to teach a lesson? Is that really the best way to help a person grow? Or does that leave them in a space of resentment and frustration and only, you know, kind of further isolates and disconnects that individual from the relationship that's using shame, right? And so in the realm of like media and in the realm of like celebrities and whatnot, right, it's effective in the sense that it really calls a person to publicly have to, you know, accept that whatever they did wasn't accepted by society, right? But at the same time, it also just develops a sense of disconnection from the community, and it doesn't really offer a whole lot of empathy and understanding.
The lady on the TED Talk I was watching, I'm trying to remember her name right now. I think it was like Betty Hart, but Betty Hart. It's TED Talk at Cherry Creek Women. She talks about canceling cancel culture. She says canceling cancel culture with compassion. And so she kind of looked at a really like micro, you know, just a private relationship in her immediate family and how she canceled that person because they had such opposing views and that it was like a deep thing for her. And so she didn't talk to this person for 10 years. And it took her some time to kind of sort through. And then later when she came back into relationships, she regretted having cut them off for so long. Also because that person, you know, passed away eventually. But that's something where I think there's a big difference between private sort of weapon or use of shame, whether you use it or weaponize it. And I actually differ guilt and shame, where guilt feels a lot like shame, but guilt is about your action and what a changeable behavior, correctable. Whereas shame, for me, it's been defined as like about who you are, like the totality of who you are and your identity and existence. So I guess that's a little bit of semantics, but that's been helpful for me. Mm-hmm. But this lady talks about how she stopped talking to that person. And so there was no longer growth or dialogue or movement for either of them because the relationship was broken. So the bridge was burned. But when they started to rebuild it, you know, she started to learn the value of, well, if I disagree with somebody because I believe that their views are dangerous, unhelpful, whatever, in this private direct relationship, I can speak into it. We can exchange ideas. I can learn their context, how they came to believe what they believe, point out what, you know, I struggle with, and I can be a part of positive change or maybe pulling them in my direction a little bit and influencing them. But if we cut off the relationship, there's no chance for that growth and repair. And so I think at the end of it, she was like, what if we pursued compassion culture instead of cancel culture, and understanding compassion not as like, oh, pity, letting them off, but like the literal, you know, calm and passion is to suffer with together and to have those really difficult conversations, which then brings me to the other video of Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. He interviewed a white comedian, Chelsea Handler, and talked about, like, what do you think about cancel culture? Because comedians are always being very non-PC and it's very public. And so that's been something I've sort of been mulling over is like, relationally, I don't want to be behaving in ways that is akin to cancel culture, and that's a private space. But when it comes to like those public things and people who have a platform whose words are important, like Trump calling the coronavirus the Asian flu or the China, you know, Wuhan stuff, and then the anti-Asian crimes that were happening after that, like that needs to be canceled for sure. But I would hope that there's somebody still trying to influence people like Trump who have that platform to realize like, hey, that was really dangerous and you need to stop, you know? Yeah, so I know it's like a lot, but these are all the things that kind of came to mind.
That's so interesting, Hannah. I'm wondering what would be the relationship between compassion culture and holding power accountable?
Yeah.
Like what could that look like? I mean, and I really struggle with Trump in that sense. Like, mm-hmm. What would compassion culture look like in that sense, or relating to him?
But I don't know if you guys have other thoughts on that, but like, I think, you know, people like us who don't have a direct relationship with Trump, I'm assuming that none of you do, we wouldn't necessarily be able to directly influence their relationship, you know, because there isn't that proximity. But at the same time, we could community organize as a lot of the AAPI and Christians did. To put out statements, to put, you know, media pressure, get it in the media, get it in the public awareness, and try to influence someone that way by speaking up and letting them know this is not okay. We're not going to vote for you, you know, or whatever ways that we try to put pressure on people to change. But I think with compassion, there are limits as well. And so when we have people in power who, when they cross boundaries and are hurting people and there's violent consequences, there's just a point where we can have compassion and empathy but still could follow through with certain consequences. But that's different from something going viral. You never stop to listen to that person, you know, give them chances, walk, you know, through the journey with them of growing and dialoguing, and just immediately public opinion and mob mentality attacking a person and, you know, possibly taking things out of context and then just being like, you're over, you're done, which has happened to quite a few people. And a lot of it's warranted because it's not the first time that people have spoken to power about it. But I think right now we're, if there's a pendulum of public accountability and calling people out, we're really, really on one side, it feels like, where people are feeling censored, right? And not able to speak up because they're afraid of being canceled. And there isn't a lot of, you know, what we Americans call freedom of speech. So I think if there is to be a balance found, we're not at that quite yet. That's how I feel.
Yeah, that's the dilemma with cancel culture, I think, is it's such a severance and permanency. It's kind of like I just canceled my Netflix. And now I have nothing to do with Netflix, and there's no dialogue, there's no restoration or restitution. Mm-hmm. And compassion culture brings in some of the emotion and empathy, but maybe correction culture, there has to be some path of restoring that relationship and bringing restitution and the public apology and the accountability, make things right, rather than cancel, then you're out of the picture and you're forever banned from society, which is what cancel culture is coming across like. And in one sense, human beings have always organized in a society, established social norms, and people that don't conform to the social norm gets some kind of punishment or marginalization. So that's always been part of human society. But I think with where we are at in this hybrid world of digital and in person, when the digital becomes so dominant and severing relationships, that's not helping us as a society to live with diverse opinions, of which much of the cancel culture tends to be the difference of opinion. And there are some that are a difference of policy. Mm-hmm. And those things have to be worked out, not just online in public, but also in person.
Yeah. I guess I have a question that I'd love to pose to us here. I think after the murder of George Floyd and, you know, the racial tensions really being heightened, and they've always been there, but being the public being so intimately aware of it and dialoguing it very openly, I think since then there's been this energy on social media that I've felt anxious about, and I've felt fear of not censorship, but fear of misspeaking. I felt a really strong need to make sure remaining within the PC bounds of my communities, because they'll look different for everyone. But also, so like kind of censoring myself in a little bit, and not wanting not to take too much risk, but still wanting to not be a bystander and be an upstander. You know, I was watching Sesame Street with my son, and they have an episode right now on PBS called The Power of We, and they explain to kids about racism, anti-racism, wow, and being a bystander versus an upstander. I mean, it was wonderful. And yeah, I mean, I was like, okay, so now they're teaching it to my 2-year-old through puppets. That's great. But then when you combine that mentality of, we always see something, say something, and then there's really fluctuating social norms that are actually getting tighter and tighter and tighter and higher moral expectations, it gets harder and harder to speak up without having a certain amount of anxiety, unless you're one of those people who've decided, I'm tired of it, I don't care about anything PC, I don't care what so-and-so thinks, the 5 people in my life know and understand me and agree, I'm just gonna say whatever I need to say, right? And there are people like that actually get lots of followers because they're not afraid. Until they get canceled, that is.
They're like, the ones who get the most followers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then if you get to certain, you know, levels of power like Trump, then social media and tech companies come in to be like, this is now dangerous. We're going to remove your microphone, sir. But yeah, have you guys also, and I keep saying you guys, but have you all or any of you felt sort of a pressure or a change in how you present yourself online and interact digitally?
Absolutely.
Except not alone.
And I'm glad you brought this up, right? And yeah, you know, I think this is, and in regards to what you had said earlier about the difference between guilt and shame, right, is there's this space in which we have to recognize that we are human and we are capable of growth and change, and that we're never all ever there, right? We don't ever make it. We are in this constant journey of growing and learning and changing based on the relationships that we're in. And when it comes to shame, it really is this thing that disconnects, right? It's this thing that tells that you're telling yourself or others are telling you that you're not worth connecting with, right? Or you lose your value and therefore you disconnect yourself from others or others disconnect themselves from you. And that's a very scary place to be, but in a hurtful place to be. But in all of that, there's this experience then in which that disconnection continues to breed disconnection in the ways that we behave, right? And we lose track of how we do relationships, who we are accountable to, and what all that looks like. And so in regards to this question of like how we present ourselves now in social media or public settings, right? My wife is always like stopping me before I post anything. She's like, George, if you really don't need to say it, just don't say it. Right? And so there's probably been, you know, a good number of rants, probably like several rants in the past month that I could have posted, but my wife was just like, please don't. But the reason being is because in the past, like I've posted stupid things, I've posted incorrect things, I've posted arrogant things, right? And in that space, I guess what social media does too is it disconnects us from our actual relationships in such a way where I don't really know or care about who's going to read this, right? I'm just trying to get it out because I need a rant, right? And then when we actually see the effects of it on our community, then we begin to fall back into that space of guilt or into that space of shame even. And I'm talking about like when I was 18 and I was a Bible thumping conservative and didn't know any better than to regurgitate the things that I'd been taught in my Christian faith, right? And I had said some really hurtful things and made a post that was really hurtful and harmful to the LGBTQ community, right? And I, in that space, felt like, no, this is what I've been taught to believe, and I should be able to voice this without any care or any understanding of what it would do to those relationships that I was connected to. And then all of a sudden, I started losing friends, right? And I started recognizing that people had distanced themselves from me, right? And 10 years since, right, there are now relationships that I know that I've harmed, right? And I know that they don't feel safe around me because I had said something hurtful, right? And this is probably a little different from cancel culture, but there is also that fear now of, wow, like someone can go back into my Facebook history, pull that up, and I could get canceled for that, right? But it's, again, the space of recognizing, like, I've grown and I've changed and I don't hold those views anymore. And I can't necessarily communicate that to those individuals who have canceled me out of their lives, right? But I can do my best to undo that hurt by reconnecting with individuals and developing that connection again through conversation, through compassion, through all these other areas that we're trying to connect in.
Yeah, for me, I've been blogging for nearly 20 years using all kinds of social media. And I think partly because of personality, I've always been careful about what I post, knowing it's public and permanent and global and instant. And I have friends across the whole spectrum, politically, theologically, and whatever. So I like harmony. I'm afraid of conflict. And I think what's happened with cancel culture, it's added an extra layer of anxiety and walking on eggshells, because I'm not just being diplomatic now. Now I'm in the shadow of, you know, will something I say get misinterpreted, trigger, cancel? But, the other part I'll mention is, it seems like in cancel cultures, some people are written off as irredeemable, and which reminds me of a separate conversation that I was listening in on, I think probably on Clubhouse. There's two kinds of approaches to the criminal justice system. Okay, so to really quantify cancel culture, where it's the worst case scenario and it's related to not just opinion, but actual crime, there's one approach of criminal justice where it's retributional, and then one that's restorative. So retributional, you just punish the criminal and you cut them out of society. Whereas restorative, you actually want to create a path and a process to restore a person to society. And I think the way cancel culture is being played out at this point in time is retributional. And I think that's not healthy for us as a society. We've got to figure out how to make it a more compassionate and corrective and restorative approach.
Aaliyah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on, especially since you're in the digital space too, and journalism.
It's complicated because I do have a lot of anxiety about the fact that cancel culture and woke culture are like, it feels like parallel tracks in many ways. And as an editor of an online magazine that talks a lot about social justice and the intersection of that and faith and all of that, and I'm a woman of color, like, and I don't know if this pressure is placed upon me or if I'm just perceiving it as such, but I have this, sometimes I struggle with this idea of like, oh, I need to be the one who is like, I hate woke language. Like, I prefer, I'd rather like think of us, all of us, as waking instead of a certain amount of woke. But there is that pressure of like, oh, you better know what you're talking about. You better be the one with the most wisdom and understanding about everything regarding to race relations and how that intersects for all of it. So you're able to make space. And so I'm constantly really battling that voice in myself. I'm personally not interested in writing a book, but I sometimes hear friends telling me, oh, you should write a book. And I'm like, I do not want to be a public figure in whatsoever. Like, it, that pressure of like, now that I'm public, I have to constantly be watching what I'm posting and just how I'm expressing myself digitally. And I want my digital space to be a fun, like, I want to post whatever I want. I post a lot of cat photos and I want, like, right? And so that, that pressure.
Yes,
and,
you do.
You're welcome. Right? And so, like, I really struggle with that pressure. And then, then I also struggle with the pressure of like, wait, am I speak? Should I be speaking out more on social media on the work I'm doing internally and like privately? Like, do I, like, it's as if I have to prove myself that I'm doing the work. And a lot of it's comes, I know, just stems from a lot of my people pleasing tendencies. But there, those are just questions I constantly really battle and wrestle with. And I don't, and I wish I could delete the apps off my phone most days, but it's part of my work at this point. So I really can't, and I sort of have to be in it. So yeah, it's really, so I admire people who take a stance of curiosity, and I admire people who, I don't know, that where they're able to brand themselves. I can, yeah, I think the whole branding part's another thing about cancel culture, right? Like, how are you branding yourself on these spaces? And because this thing, when you're selling a product, whether it is an organization or yourself or whatever it is, there's still a level of virtue signaling that's required so people know whether you're safe or not, right? So yeah, it's a weird struggle for me.
Yeah, it's complicated for all of us.
Well, here's the thing. So I have a 24-year-old son. He doesn't do social media, so the impact that social media and cancel culture is causing on the next generation, Gen Z, whatever you want to call it, is they don't do any social media for fear of being misunderstood and possibly anything they say will be used against them.
Yes. Yeah.
And which leaves only the bad people using social media. So when the good people don't use it properly, then the bad people use it and weaponize it, and it just makes things worse. And I think that's what's feeding into our polarization and the demise of American culture. And then the on top of that, because it's the negative and the controversial things that get attention on social media, then big tech wants the negative stuff. So it just creates this vicious cycle that's harmful to society.
What do y'all think about, you know, so in the House Judiciary Committee right now, there's a Republican asking, I think the leader of the committee is a Democrat, to explore the harmful effects and dangers of cancel culture and to introduce, I think he wants to introduce legislation. And one of the things I read, I don't know if it was specifically this guy, but some people want to introduce a bill to protect, I think mostly white people and conservatives, for their political views. So basically Republicans or, you know, very conservative people or Trump supporters would be a protected political class. In the name of, we need to protect freedom of speech. The liberals are in power right now, so we need to make sure that the conservatives don't get their microphones taken away from them. And I, it made me pause because I think our conversation is lending towards cancel culture can be quite dangerous and bring up a lot of anxiety and break relationship. And it's really at kind of, you know, a certain part of the pendulum swing. But I'm really torn about this because I don't want to see legislation also protect white supremacy, you know, because that's a real thing. Not that all Republicans are white supremacists, but I think a lot of younger people view it that way because of Trump's, you know, hurtful legacy here. So, yeah, any thoughts there?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is what conservatives now see as a danger in cancel culture, right? It's ironic that they didn't, that because it wasn't called cancel culture earlier, right? When they were essentially practicing it, right? That it's something that they fear being used against themselves now. And it is really a pendulum swing or like a, you know, a response to the ways that they've canceled others and marginalized others and silenced others, right? And it's frustrating because they want to fight for these rights for themselves, right, or these protections for themselves. But then you look at the way that they dealt with the Kavanaugh situation and canceling victims of sexual abuse or sexual assault and like trying to do whatever they can in their power to invalidate someone's speech, right? Because of whatever they can find, whatever dirt they can find on a person. And so it's so almost hypocritical in that sense that if it's only to protect me, then yes, I want this protection, right? But at the same time, I'm still using whatever I can to still perpetuate the cancel culture in other areas. So it is very self-serving in that sense. And that's what makes it frustrating and difficult to get behind because it's so blatant that it's self-serving. And again, if the goal was simply to protect yourself, then yeah, we should get rid of cancel culture. But the goal ought to be, again, how are we actually developing understanding and empathy for each other's situations? But again, yeah, it's just a circle of a conversation because then we get back to this place of, well, how do we hold leadership accountable? How do we get into these places where leaders who ought to know better and are held to a higher standard, that they don't get away with, oh, well, let's be compassionate towards them. unnecessarily. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. Well, we hear Erase and Shame care about empathy, but it seems to me there's also a group of people that don't care about empathy. Mm-hmm. They just want to impose their view on society because they believe in this a very strong black and white, right and wrong kind of world. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting the feeling that we can go in circles about the dilemma of cancel culture. Mm-hmm. But let's reimagine. Well, what can we do to reshape the conversation towards something hopeful that can correct it or untangle it?
I feel like I've been talking a lot. Did you have thoughts on anything George said or we were talking about earlier?
No, my brain's mulling.
Like soaking. I really am liking this compassion culture thing, and I'm thinking that our one-on-one relationships can inform how we are in public as well. So for example, like, you know, Trump's like the biggest narcissist I can, you know, point to with the biggest power platform he's abused. We can set boundaries with individuals like Trump, whether it's one-on-one with him mistreating and dehumanizing women and men around him, just to say like, no, you know, stop. I mean, you know, and Bible gives us sort of a picture of like stages of confrontation and conflict resolution. But even the Bible says at some point you need to just end the relationship because they're not teachable. Maybe not ever or not at that point, but in any case, create distance, you know, and no longer journey with that person until they maybe come back repentant, if ever. And then Trump, we call, you know, narcissist, and we look at him as having mental health issues and a personality disorder as well. And so with someone like Trump, you can say it again and again and again, and people have been, but there's been no change. So at some point, we need to be like, no, this needs to end. So thus people calling for impeachment, and impeachment's like the political canceling, I guess. And we like failed to do that properly. I like that idea of like, if we move towards, yes, call people out, and do it with the point of asking for accountability, but also like repair. So with restorative justice or RJ, like in the school system, the victim gets to speak and say, this is what I need for you to make amends to restore relationship with me. If there is going to be a boundary relationship at all, I can choose. And also, how do you make amends to our community? Because there's been a rupture in safety, you know? So then you think of criminals doing community service and going to therapy and other things, right? But I think there's a limit to it. So I'm kind of looking at this model of like, keep dialoguing with people, keep calling them out. If you need to remove them from a position of power, fine. If you need to remove the microphone of Twitter or whatever, fine. But if they show true signs of change or repentance or turning things around and changing their behavior, as you know, many notable people have done, then to hear them out. So it's like if, you know, I have a microphone here, DJ has given us all. If cancel culture and dialogue, and if all that on the digital space looks like we're all in the room together, a large room together, and we're all carrying our own microphones. Some of us, the volume is much higher, and we have the ability to cut and mute people's microphones. Well, if the bully with the biggest, loudest mic is cutting off everybody else's mic, and they're, you know, creating chaos and hurting people, take his mic away after a while. But that doesn't mean he has to be kicked out of the room permanently. I mean, he may need to be escorted out of the room because he's a dangerous person who's hurting people with his presence and his words. But if he's willing to dialogue and listen without a mic for a while and show signs of change and willing to make amends to let him back into the room and consider giving him a mic again, but with boundaries in a graduated process. So that's kind of coming to mind for me with that metaphor. But for some people, it's just not going to work. Right. I don't.
Yeah, we saw that at the presidential level. I mean, there was a moderator with two presidents that are running our country.
I know.
And the moderator could not manage the conversation because one person was not willing to listen.
Yeah.
And so just to have that idea of a civil discussion is out of reach for some people.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that we've come to this point in America.
Yeah.
At every level, in a sense, because it's reached the top. So it's certainly reflective of what's happening at the grassroots level. So we need peacemakers.
Yeah.
So I think one way forward is we need peacemakers that can bring people together and have just common decency and respect for people being people and not not dehumanize people. And
Yeah, and I think that's the big part for me is there's this dehumanization that comes out of shaming, right? And oftentimes, in order to dehumanize someone, right, you either have to dehumanize yourself a bit, right? You strip away a bit of your humanity in order to strip away someone else's. And when we get to these places, when we meet these individuals who are so dehumanizing in their speech and their actions and the ways that they engage with others, like there's a space in which you really, and this is that compassion piece, right? There, you really have to be able to ask, how dehumanized have you made yourself, or how dehumanized have you become to become this kind of a person, right? And let's restore bits of your humanity to really get you to recognize that what you're doing and how you're engaging with others is really damaging, right? And is really harmful. And it's that question where I'm like thinking to myself, oh goodness, what would it be like to sit in a room with Trump and to kind of go through this with him, right? And of course it almost seems impossible, and like there are a number of, but like just with normal people, right? People that we care for, people that we love, people that we don't want to cancel but feel like we need to, right? There's a space where we really have to come, you know, recognizing our own pain in the ways that we've been shamed, right? But also having to come back and say, okay, something's happening here with you that you feel like you have to give out to other people. And that's not the case. Right. So let's go back and restore those bits of you so that you can actually live in this community well. Right. And as we were talking about this, what came back to mind for me was there was a story floating around on Facebook of an African tribe that handles misdeeds within their community. And what they do is they bring that person in front of every person in the community. And then that community then speaks truth into them and speaks about their good deeds and reminds them of who they are as a good person. And they recognize that that misdeed that they had committed was really a cry for help, a cry out of disconnection, right? And so there's a space in which we really have to bring back humanity to people who constantly dehumanize others and help them recognize that the way that they're living isn't the only way that they can live, or isn't the way that they, you know, could be living, but there's so much more good in them that can be experienced and that has been experienced, as opposed to these negative things that we want to highlight, these negative things that social media wants to bring out and focus on and whatnot. So
it's brilliant, George. It's dehumanizing to dehumanize. We as a humanity can do our best to restore people to their humanity.
Yeah.
Closing word from Hannah and Leah.
Yeah, I'm like soaking in the wisdom that George just dropped right there. That was amazing. Yeah. I think DJ, when you talked about we need peacemakers, I was thinking especially as a mental health professional, and I used to be in ministry, that's, you know, being a bridge and a peacemaker and being someone who stands in the gap and an intercessor. It's all, those are all callings and identities and labels that I've been like, yes, yes, I want that. You know, I feel called to that. That feels like something I really value. But something that I have been wrestling with, especially during the pandemic and with everything going on since last year, has been that it's really hard. It's really hard to stand and not be triggered. It's really hard to navigate when I speak and when I don't, you know. It's really hard to figure out what's right and wrong sometimes and what's up or down. It's hard. It's really, really hard, but it's still worth doing. And I think if, you know, anybody else listening out there, like, it's hard work. And if you're doing it, thank you. yeah. So, you know, the whole ideas, and I'm kind of going back a lot to my own spiritual traditions and faith here, but like the whole idea of being like salt and light and standing in the gap. I took a lot of that for granted and didn't understand the pain and suffering involved in that growing up. And now it's like, oh, I have to work through my offense and be able to listen to both sides, or I have to listen to someone who's like deeply, deeply offended and hurt me and try and understand where they're coming from, and at the same time sit with my own pain and process it. Oh my God, I don't know how to do that by myself. So yeah, I think it's important, but it's really hard. It's hard work. So I'm glad we have these safe spaces to discuss, and that we're not alone in doing it. Yeah.
I am just thinking about all the people who have a lot of social anxiety when it comes to sharing and expressing themselves in cancel culture. And I just wanted to say that I see you and I know firsthand how hard it is. And I hope you remember to show yourself some grace and some kindness and some compassion, the same compassion you wish cancel culture would embrace. Show that same compassion to yourself through this process.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, viewers and listeners, for tuning in and finishing this episode of Erasing Shame. We'd love to have your perspective amongst our diverse perspective discussing what matters. We invite you to join our community and let's bring restoration and correction to this cancel culture that we're in the shadow of. So thank you for listening. We'll see you next month.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Erasing Shame podcast. Check out our website at erasingshame.com. We would love to hear your comments and questions. Please subscribe on any podcast app like Apple, Google, Spotify, or on Facebook and YouTube. And please add a rating, a review, and a share so more people can experience the freedom and healing that comes from Erasing Shame.